So for our next podcast on Serving First, we have another special guest. He's an artist, a musician, a rapper, a filmmaker, a person of many talents, and in addition, he brings that New York vibe. Please welcome Imar Kenemo.
Hey, how are you doing, Sledge?
Yeah, good to hear from you. How are you?
I'm good. Not too bad. I just had a little pasta for lunch, so just kind of, you know, trying to enjoy the rest of the day. Every day is good if you eat pasta. This is my theory of life.
Oh, why not? Didn't you just come back from Italy a while ago?
I did. I kind of had to. Are you now trying to imply that all I do is eat pasta?
I wasn't suggesting that at all, I promise.
No, but it's cool. Listening to your introduction, though, going back to that, I was just kind of like thinking like, yeah, I really do too much. I'm kind of like trying to cut down on some of those things. If there was like, because I find like so many titles today are made up. I don't know if you've ever looked on LinkedIn and some people's like job titles just seem like really strange. It's not like back in the day you could just have a title. You can be a carpenter, you can be this, you can be that. Now, you know, everyone can do so much. It's kind of like they just make up job titles. Like,
yeah,
I'm senior vice president of Instagram likes. That's what I do sometimes.
It's interesting because all the things I read before, artist, musician, I mean, these are the things you do. And I've seen some of your work and it's really impressive. You work with some very well-known people, some very talented people. How did you get into all this? I mean, what drove you, what brought you towards music and filmmaking?
Okay, well, that's a good question. I guess first thing I remember is I was young, around the age of 12. I mean, I've always loved music growing up. My parents always had really great records. I've stolen a lot of those records and have them with me here today in London. And I still listen to those records. And it's weird, but my fondest memory is me kind of going into my older brother's rooms, because I'm the last born of 12 kids. And obviously with that, you kind of have all kinds of generations in your household to be able to kind of pick through. You know, it's like little time machines you can go. I can go to my parents, which will be the oldest. Then I have my older brothers and what they were into, listen to music from like the 70s to 80s coming up. So it was a lot of choice for me. But I remember falling in love specifically with hip hop from my older brother, Patrick. He was a big hip hop fan, and he had really great clothing. And I used to try to steal his clothes. I couldn't fit in them, obviously, but I'd still try it on. And I'd look at myself in the mirror and try to like kind of just, you know, kind of pretend I'm this cool guy that my brother is. And the first thing I listened to was Coolio. And he had a Coolio album, and he had a Fresh Prince album. And I think that the single at the time was like Boom Boom Shake Shake the Room, which was like really
Those early 90s, mid-90s, right?
Exactly. So I remember like really listening to that, and it's kind of just made me fall in love with the rhyming aspect. And as I was growing up, so 12, 13, 14, I started kind of rapping myself. And I remember, to stay out of trouble, because I grew up in Harlem, we had like a youth center, which used to have like a hip-hop battles where you'd come in, you know, you'd have your best rhymes and you just freestyle and try to, they'd have little competitions and give somebody like, I don't know, $50 or whatever if you win.
And I remember like the rap battles we see in 8 Mile, that kind of thing.
Yeah, but not really. It's more kind of like youth center, not as aggressive as that, you know, like there's no 14-year-olds with guns here. it was just kind of really light. It was just like a lot of kids who were trying to stay out of trouble, you know. So we just kind of got in, and you find yourself through that. So I remember I won my first battle when I was like 13, so a year after.
Wow.
Yeah. And I think I won something like $100 because the price is going up because they couldn't determine who the final guy was. I think I'm still friends with this guy who I beat somehow. I don't know what's going on with his life. I need to check. You know, Facebook, when you have like old friends that you don't even talk to. But
are you still friends after the competition, though?
I think so. I think we might have not talked because I did. I really whooped his ass. I mean, I don't. it wasn't the kind of ass whooping a 13-year-old should take from a 13-year-old. But it was really, really cool. After that, I got so motivated because, you know, it felt like I'd won something. The last thing I won was maybe like a karate championship when I was 5 or something. You know, but it was kind of crazy. So after that, I started taking music more seriously. I wanted to know what to do. What's the next stage? How do you cut a record? How do you get a song out there? And my older brother, you know, the same cool guy who's kind of influenced me. Oh, hold on one second.
Wow, what was that?
No clue. One second.
Maybe that's the friend you beat. He's been waiting all these years for revenge.
Oh, no worries. I was just checking a chair. Oh. a chair fell in my house. I thought I was having an earthquake. Oh, okay. That would have made your podcast a lot more interesting. I mean, if that was happening right then, oh, man. The views.
The first big earthquake in London for years. It happened to be caught on a podcast.
Right here. You know what I mean? Yeah. But going back to where what your question was, I think after I started trying to make music around the age of 13, 14, my brother bought me a beat machine, right? And with a beat machine, you kind of produce your own music. You know, you make like a boom bap sound and then you just write your rhymes over it. And I wasn't the greatest producer because I find that I'm not that patient. And still today, I never went into producing. Producing is when you actually make the beats and, you know, you sit there crafting away, trying to make the sound aspect of it. I just fell in love with the words, and I love words. Words are like my favorite thing on the planet, you know, whether it's like how things sound, alliteration, this, that, you know, like, you know, and metaphors as well, and double entendres, and hip hop is filled with these great pieces of poetry, which if you actually took words off and off like lyrics and like had a look at them without the music, a lot of hip hop is just poetical, right?
Yeah.
And so that's what I loved about it. I love the words. So I never got into producing. I made like one beat and then I was like so proud of myself, but I found that I only made like a boom bap, rapped for like 15 seconds and I was like, yes, that's complete. And then I realized like songs at the time, you know, a full song is like something like 3 minutes, 30 seconds. I could never get past that point. I could only write one verse every time. And eventually I think I broke that hurdle around 15 when I made a full song, and I can remember it was called Pebble Rose or something. I was talking about some girl at the time. Girls became a thing after puberty, obviously.
Yeah, that's always a motivation for lots of songs.
It's true. The greatest music in the world is inspired by love.
Love songs, heartbreaking songs. Yeah.
And that was it. But so after that, so it's funny because my link to film and my link to music are born from the same thing, you know? So I then got even more serious around 16. I had my first record out, you know, it was called Be That Star. Can't remember. And it was like an album of like 14 songs. I'd managed to find a producer to work with.
Wow.
Yeah. So at that time I was like, oh, really excited about having that out. And I'd met a Korean DJ who used to DJ for Zulu Nation. And that was like really good because Zulu Nation is one of the originators of kind of hip hop, because Afrika Bambaataa, who's supposed to like have pretty much born hip hop, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
He birthed the hip hop in New York at the time, which was really cool. So this DJ was like pretty much like I'd found something incredible, and he really wanted to work with me. So we started working with each other, making a couple records. That was really great. So I completed that. Didn't really go anywhere, but I was just happy that I completed something. And then the next phase from that is like, oh, cool. Now that I'm a fully fledged rapper, clearly I can't be a fully fledged rapper if I don't have a music video, you know, like that's always the next thing. So I remember trying to get a music video around the age of 17, 18. So a year after that record, I was still trying to find somebody to do this. And no one was kind of doing it for free at the time. It wasn't easy to find somebody to kind of help you out with music videos, and that's when I was like, you know what, I'm just gonna shoot it myself. Like I was like, you know what, I've had enough. I need to find the camera. I'll make it happen. I always have. So got a camera, started falling in love with film after I shot my first video called The High or whatever. It was just incredible. Like that, I'd never had such a kick from kind of shooting and getting something to look awesome. And then what I noticed was my video, albeit I did it all by myself, was actually like pretty, like, not bad for like a kid that just did it first time. And I was looking at other people's videos. Oh, you know what? You know, this is kind of better, I think, you know? And this is where my mentality goes. It's like, I always go overconfident into everything just so when I execute it, I can kind of continue to believe in myself. I don't have a moment of doubt, you know? You have to just keep going. So after I did that, I was kind of like, oh, great. Then I started, you know, watching films and learning about the science behind film, cinematography, this, that. And I remember, so I wanted to major in film, and I applied to get into Columbia to do pretty much my first major. But at the same time, my brother, same guy, Patrick, he had moved over to London to study at King's College because he's also one of the smartest in the family. He was supposed to come here and do medicine or whatever, but he came over and did pharmacy, stayed here for a while. And at the time, I was also kind of growing up and trying to avoid a lot of things. A lot of your old friends are growing up. Some were in, like, getting in trouble. Some were doing that. And my dad at the time was like, you know, just to avoid these kind of energies, why don't you go check London out? And I remember my first time coming over to London, just kind of visit my brother. Came over here. It was a really weird energy. Like, I'd never seen such a place like this. Because, for one, it was like having the... Especially being black, I find that was like really weird because being black in America, black in London are two separate things. Here it's like, you know, there's still oppression, there's still prejudice, there's still racism, but it's done with class here. So you don't really feel it. You don't feel it as much, you know what I mean? You know, it's like they'll smile in your face and then make it feel normal. But, you know, with that, so it was kind of like a strange feeling. I didn't stick around long enough. Went away, came back, and then I came to London to do film. So that's after I came here for a little bit of inspiration, didn't like it, went away, came back, and then I came here to go to Westminster University where I did film. And
wow, okay. I actually didn't know that.
Yeah, it's crazy. So I did film here in the UK, and then I graduated when I was 21. And then after that time, I'd already kind of had some really interesting jobs. So between 18 and 21, the Korean DJ had actually connected me to a company called Comca, which is really cool. And this company, basically, they're a publishing company. So I got to write songs for K-pop artists at the time who were trying to break into the West because K-pop started really taking off.
Yeah.
So I got to go
live. That's Korean pop.
Yeah, Korean pop, exactly. Yeah. I got to go live in Korea after I graduated for maybe quite a while.
Is this around the time of Gangnam Style?
Yes, a little bit.
Yeah,
2011-12. I think Gangnam Style, so I think it was like 22 when that came out. So Gangnam Style,
yeah, it's 2012,
right? So then I went over to Korea and I started songwriting for some of the guys, and I think I did 2 years in Seoul or so, just under 2 years, and I was there for a while. So that was another experience, you know, like they just gave me a credit card and I got to drink every day, I got to party every day. It was like an incredible thing. And this card, I could put anything in this card. I'd never had an experience like this. Am I really going to deliver here? Like, who do they think I am? Like, I'm like, I've never done anything like this. I'm just a kid from Harlem.
I think they love the New York accent.
Maybe that's the charm of it all. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And after all this time here, maybe that's why I'm hanging on to it. I'm not like, what, mate? How's it going, brother? You know, not any of that stuff. But what happened? So after I stayed in Seoul for a very long time. And that was a weird culture shock for me too. I mean, I don't know if have you ever gone somewhere and stayed for a while and like had that feeling. I don't know if you've ever like traveled for a long time.
I actually lived in New York for a year years ago. That's where I did my filmmaking. That's where film directing in the New York Film Academy, and that was a whole year in 2004. And it was definitely a new experience. I mean, I'd been to New York before. I traveled around the world, and I think just living in New York felt for me very natural. I always loved the place, I think I always find that New York, and I don't know how we got into New York, but I always found that New York is one of those few places in the world that you feel like you know before you got there, because you see it in every second movie.
That's true.
And so once you got this, like, I've seen this before. I've seen this look with all the taxis parked. You feel like you've seen that scene before in a movie.
Mm-hmm.
And it just felt very normal and natural to be there. I thought of it as London with tall buildings. And that's kind of the way I see it. And but I actually didn't know about you when you traveled so much. I didn't know you actually studied in London.
I came to London to do my first major, man. Like, that's the whole thing. I mean, I was supposed to go to Columbia, and then my brother, after seeing my brother out here, and the difference was this. The main drive was I knew so many New Yorkers that have never left the city. And I mean, in New York State, let's say, you know, they've never been even to other states. And I was like, that's not me. I come from a very kind of, I'm lucky enough to have a good enough family that has kind of been a little bit everywhere. You know, culturally, it's very different than like your standard New York family. Like, my dad's Tanzanian, my mom's Portuguese, you know, like, so the backgrounds are different, you know. So with that said, traveling to London, came out here, and it was a weird vibe, like I said. Came back and enjoyed it better. Like, I've made really good friends since then, and that's what drove me to kind of stick around, is because of that. Is I saw, okay, as an opportunity, why be another filmmaker in LA? You know, like, you know how many filmmakers are in LA? Like, everybody goes there, and it's like Hollywood, Hollywood, Hollywood. I didn't want to be another filmmaker from America, basically. I always loved foreign films, especially Asian films and you know, Oriental Asian. I kind of really liked Japanese movies, Korean movies, and really got into the cinematography aspect of it. So all of this was happening, and I still did music too, because even though I was falling in love with film, music was always been my first love. So I kind of still did that. And I remember everything good musically or film wise had always happened to me in London. Yep. Also, because I first opened for J. Cole, who's now like a really big artist, kind of like in hip hop anyway. And I opened for him in London. Like in London, I opened for one of his shows when he came out of here. So that happened in London, you know, while I was in college. And then right after that, I pretty much opened for Blackstreet, who did No Diggity, No Doubt, you know, who are also like a classic hip hop group. Well, you know, more R&B group. And that was all happening here. So I was like, there's got to be like, clearly the universe is kind of is letting me know something about the city and me kind of connect, right? So I stuck around enough and managed to get indefinite leave just before my brother left, so I could kind of live and work here anyway.
Interesting, yeah.
Yeah, sure.
Did you find, I mean, I found, for example, I think I made the mistake of coming back to London after I was in New York, and I felt like I had to start from scratch. And I think it's good that you didn't make that mistake. You realized like you had a lot of contacts and friends and things, and you decided to stay on to take your opportunities. I think was very wise.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. I think that's a big part of it. But I also think the difference is when I stayed in Korea, right? I lived there long enough to start feeling lonely. And London and New York are similar in the sense that it's multicultural. So it's a big part of it. Like in Seoul, you would be the only like black dude there. Like you look around and occasionally see another black dude, but it's not the same. Even though it's a major city, it's still not as cultural, multicultural as say London or New York, right?
Yeah.
And so leaving, coming to London, I didn't feel too different in the sense that I could still communicate. There's no big language barrier if I need to, you know, get a job or do some work. I find like even if I do go back to New York now, I've amassed enough of a portfolio to be able to re-engage new connections and new friendships. You're right. At the beginning, it would have been difficult, but without a portfolio and only like a degree like anybody else has. But I think the difference is after you spend enough time somewhere, doesn't matter where, as long as you've worked enough to amass or get enough portfolio, you can pretty much go anywhere, you know. And so that was how kind of I was looking at it. But then after the J. Cole stuff, after all that stuff, I released a couple more albums out here, and I took a break from music for a while. I think around as I was getting older, maybe because life was getting a little different. It was the constraints of trying to complete music and work and do film and also having to pay your bills and do that, but I've always tried to find enough time. So I released a project in 2014 called Beauty and the American Beast. It did really well, which was really cool. But after that, 2015, I didn't release anything. 2016, didn't release anything. And I also found it really affects my energy, like my mood. So I just kind of decided I need to get back into music. And so 2016, I decided I'm going to make a new project. And so for the past 2 years or so, I'd say I've really been kind of on it again. But now with these newfound skills, like still not letting people shoot my music video, by the way, because that's still the thing that I've decided to do. I'm like, you know what, I can do it all, so let me just take care of it. And that's it, and that's where I am now. Wow. I'm just trying to still pursue both loves of my life.
Interesting, because it sounds like you got into it just almost by accident, just from the love of music. You talked about the contest you had when you were 13, and some of it also the filmmaking talent really started out as a necessity.
Exactly.
You had to make your own music videos and you couldn't find the right people to help you. Did you find any resistance growing up? Did you find any resistance at any stage of this process from people from outside? Were there moments or any specific moments where you felt like it was a turning point, or maybe you just found like hurdles to climb that for whatever reason, whether it's being an American or just feeling different or an outsider, or maybe, you know, how there's resistance from parents thinking, oh, this isn't going to work as a career. I've heard that kind of story before from others.
Yeah.
Anything that got in your way?
Yeah, I mean, for sure. And that's always the case, especially with the kind of background I told you. Like, my dad is very, he has very African roots, and in that kind of household, you know, my dad really wants a doctorate, lawyer, things of substance, you know, practices that kind of have been around long enough. You know, he'd even take a teacher as well. Like, he loved education also. He's very fond of all of his professors and very, very fond of all that, you know. So, and he's a very well-educated man. So in his mind, he just wanted the same for his children, right? So I remember when I was on my way to London, and we had had an agreement. We had a big conversation with my pops, like, when we were talking about everything. He was like, oh, cool, so what are you going to study, you know? And he assumed I was coming to London to study law. And that was the thing. And I'd got into King's College too, actually. And I was supposed to...
Oh, so that was your degree? Yeah. That was what it was supposed to be.
I was supposed to come over to London to major in law, right? And I came out here, and I did, like, I think, like, 6 months or something at King's. And I was like, this isn't for me. You know, I'm kind of like, this is definitely not for me. I could do it. I know I could. I'm you know, I find myself like I'm not. It's not that I wasn't intelligent enough or didn't find a challenge enough. Yeah. It was just more the fact that I just knew, looking at everybody else in my family and looking at how I am, I knew that I'm not the type of person to just do something to make somebody else happy if my own happiness isn't included somehow, right?
Yeah.
And because I know it's going to affect the rest of my life. I always used to assess things like this. So I kind of decided, okay, I could do one of two things. Call my pops and tell them, yo, this is not what I want to do, and just go back home and not do anything. Or I can just try to major in something else. And then I remember I going back and forth with the Westminster admin and letting them know, you know, they had to see all my papers, all my scores, whatever. And finally, I settled on doing kind of like film, but it was like an agreement kind of thing, because I did my master's in film, but on my first thing, so it was like a combined degree in doing music informatics. Like computer programming for musicians. So there was a part of the course that was also part of that also. So I had to do that, and then I also had to come back and do my master's as well at Westminster. So after all of that was done, I was finally like, okay, cool. I mean, you know, my pop still thinks I'm doing law, still thinks I'm doing the bar exam. And then he keep hitting me up like, hey, how are you doing? How's everything going? I'm like, yeah, law's great. You know, if you ever get in any trouble and you need me to get you out, you know, I'm here, I got you. And I was just making all this up, kind of joking with him. But when he found out that I wasn't doing law, he was very disappointed. And I didn't talk to my dad for like 2 years, you know?
Wow.
It was a very, very long time. And for me, that was the most difficult thing, considering how close I am with my father. So that was kind of the hardest drawback to everything. And I remember really just having to be ignorant about my emotions towards that. I had to be like, you know what, forget it. I just need to keep going forward. You know, I had to block out the emotion, because I know if I'd fallen into that trap, I would have just kind of not pursued what I'm doing and then try to please somebody else, you know? So I remember after the 2 years, eventually after I graduated, you know, I find like when the older parents get, the kind of less strict they become. I don't know if a lot of other people, hopefully when people get older, they'll start realizing that. I think like when parents get older, they start realizing that they don't really control everything. I think that's...
I definitely agree with you.
I mean, that's one aspect of it. They start realizing they don't control everything, and then they become a little more lenient, and then they're like, you know, what will be. This is the kid we had. Yeah. This is who he's always been. So we kind of had a really cool conversation, and I was doing some great things with film at the time, so he was kind of proud and didn't expect anyone to do that. And out of all of his kids, me and my older sister, the one who's like a year older than I am, we're the most like the black sheep of the family. You know, she lives in Dubai and also is like a tyrant when it comes to not doing people's, going about people's way. But, and that's it. And we kind of solved our relationship because he was proud of what I was doing. We had a real conversation. We reconnected. That was such a beautiful part of my life. I remember just being happy that I stuck it out, because if I hadn't, I would have not done anything, you know, and then I wouldn't have been who I am today. So for me, that was the biggest adversity I'd faced, not having to deal with growing up with, like, you know, drug dealers or this or that. Like, all of that is, you know, it's very small in comparison to, like, having my father around, you know?
Yeah, that's a really great story to share, actually. I think there's so many things you've said, and I've got so many questions. I've kind of lost track of which questions to ask you now. So I'm thinking I should have written some notes at some point. But actually, it's interesting what you said about the culture, your father being from Tanzania and your mother from Portugal, and the expectations they had on you. And it's true. It's very similar in an Asian kind of Indian culture as well, where I think you're expected to be like a certain type of job or a certain type of career. And then if it's not that, then it's almost like you're an outsider. And it's also true what you said about as your parents get older, they start to accept it and think, you know what, as long as he's happy and as long as he's doing his thing, and that's cool. I think one thing you said quite early on, you said you were the youngest of 12?
Yeah.
12?
12 kids, man. I am number 12. So that's
number 12.
That's the number. This is me.
Well, how did that feel growing up? I mean, how was it? I'm just curious because I'm the oldest of two.
Okay. I think that's
probably the other way around.
It's the other way around.
So I'm just curious how it works the other way around, the other extreme.
It's really interesting because I think I was always trying to prove that I'm old enough for certain things. I remember having conversations and arguments and fights, and I used to really fight it. You know, I used to fight, why are you treating me like a kid? I really remember that was like the toughest part for me growing up. It was like, you have your
own. I'm guessing this was when you were a kid.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
Right. Okay, yeah.
You have to still prove it. Well, now that I'm older, I don't listen to anybody. So there's, I'm still a kid. But now I have the pride, I can just ignore a phone call and get a, I pay bills now. I don't have to listen to anybody.
Yeah.
So that's just how it is. But when I remember being younger, and I remember I wrote a book when I was like around the age of like 13, 14. I was writing a stupid book because I'd had a huge argument with like my older brother because I was trying to, I can't even remember what it was about now, but I just remember he had the power because he was older. And this power aspect of it was like, why is he entitled to it? I don't think I'm any less intelligent, any this, you know? And I was basing it all on intelligence because I thought I was really challenging my thoughts more so than a 14-year-old should be. Right. So I wrote this book called Who Knows the End of the World. Right. And
you were 14.
Yeah. Around 13, 14. Yeah. And it was just all written in pages. And I was walking around. I was like the only kid in New York with a briefcase, you know? So I found my dad's old briefcase. And I was like, cool, this is my look right now. You know, I'm going to pull it off. And I think I pulled it off too, because nobody tried to clown on me or pull anything out of me. So I was like, all right. Either that or just they were too scared and thought I was some homeless kid that just had a briefcase. You know, it's like Pulp Fiction. They didn't know what was in the briefcase. So yeah, that's the whole thing.
And not knowing kind of put some fear in them.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But I wrote this book called Who Knows the End of the World. And it was awesome because what I was saying in the book, and I remember so clearly this message, my mom still had it somewhere, was basically the fact that it doesn't matter whether you're 10 or you're 103, you know, no matter what your experience is, you don't know when the world will end. You don't have the finite day. You don't have the exact time. You don't have your knowledge is the same. We're both the same is what I was trying to explain, right? That it doesn't matter about the age aspect. We're also, and if you look at everything in the grand scheme of things, we're just as clueless as each other. And that's at the heart of it is what I was trying to kind of explain to my brother. So maybe this book was like some letter to my brother or whatever. But
it's interesting. I agree. I think just tying on to that, I always felt you're ready when you're ready.
Exactly.
Doesn't matter the age, how young or old you are. And I think you said at the end, you wrote the book as almost a message to your brother.
Yeah. And also I wanted to do it in an intellectual way, because if I'd just gone over and started yelling, be like, look at this crazy guy. Like, I find like when you, and again, that's the love of words. Like you can say things in so many ways. And if you just, everything is language. If you say it in the right way, and I don't mean language like English, Spanish, I mean like languages in communication, you know, I could say one thing to you and say the same thing to somebody else and they could be offended and you could not. It's all about me learning how to say it to that other person as well, so they understand exactly what I was saying, you know. And that's it. For me, it was such a weird thing to look back on. And I haven't even thought about it like that story for a long time. So just having this conversation with you is like, just brought that out. It's really weird.
Well, it's interesting, just even hearing you in the last few minutes, I feel like I've learned more about you in the last half an hour than I have in the last couple of years, all the time I've known you. And I always knew you were obviously a singer, an artist, but I didn't know you had a real love for words like this. and that you had this real kind of connection with words rather than the producer side. Mm-hmm. And that's quite interesting as well, because I know you've got your own studio and you can do the producing, but exactly. Your real passion lies with the words.
With the words, that's
pretty and the singing, yeah. And the creation of the words and the poetry side of the artistic side.
Exactly.
Who are your role models? What's your inspiration in life? Anyone you'd like to work with?
It's funny. I've kind of gone in a really weird direction. I remember, so like growing up, you have your main inspirations, right? I had like so for me, I remember first person was okay. Actually, first CD I ever got was the Spice Girls. It wasn't mine. I think I stole it from my sister or something. And she had like a Walkman at the time, and then you could put like a disc drive.
Sorry, I think we've got a glitch on the radio. I heard the word Spice Girls.
One of my sisters.
Nothing against the Spice Girls. I like the Spice Girls.
Spice Girls were huge, man. Like,
they were.
But I remember it was the first one of the first CDs in my house. You know what I mean? Because we had a lot of vinyls or whatever. So I don't know whose it was, but I remember stealing it or taking it from somebody, because I'd got a Walkman or something like that from one of my uncles.
Yeah.
And so I needed a CD. You can't just be listening to a Walkman without a CD. So I'm like, okay.
Yeah.
It so happened to be the Spice Girls. And then that was the album I was like playing back and forth, because it's the only CD I've had. Nobody looked in my Walkman, though. So they didn't know what I was playing, but it was great. And then after that, that's when I kind of started falling in love, right? I found Boom Boom Shake the Room. I found Coolio. Yeah. I found all these others. But I remember also then growing up and coming into like DMX. And then DMX was like a little more lyrical than some of the other previous artists. He was very loud and he's such a performer, you know, like always bark. I mean, what other hip hop artist barks on a track? You know, literally barking like, wah, wah, wah. I was like, this is some really weird shit, but why is it awesome? You know, like, and so, and that was really cool. And then I got into Nas. And New York's kind of like that. You have like different boroughs. So like every borough's got their own kind of vibe and different artists and different people in the city. And Nas was such a lyricist. I've never heard someone say such poetical things, you know, like in one of his songs, he's like, sleep is a cousin of death. And, you know, and this might have been like popular knowledge to most people who were reading great books at the time or whatever. But he was saying things and attaching them to the culture that we're growing up in. Right. So there's really profound information. And I was like, wow, I'd never heard anything like it. It was so intelligent, so well put together. Until today, Nas is like definitely one of the best lyricists that's ever lived. You know, and you can't replicate his style. And I really tried. And this is when I knew the difference between creating something that's original and creating something that's kind of like a copy. Like if someone is truly original and someone is truly themselves, they're almost very difficult to imitate. You'll always come, you know, and I could never imitate Nas. I could try to imitate DMX. I just have to, you know, bark on the track and do a few things. I could always imitate a few other people, but Nas was impossible. And so he was like my Everest, right? I looked at it like,
that was your benchmark.
I'm like, could I ever outwrite this person? And then, so I kept writing, and then I started falling in love with lyrical music, you know, like, cool. Like everybody else. Sure. I love Tupac. I love Biggie, but for me, hearing Nas and how
something about
how articulate he was, and there's a big competition between Nas and Jay-Z in the hip hop world. Like, you know, who's your favorite between those two? But Jay-Z had flow. He sounded great. He had very good like mannerisms. His metaphors and double entendres were great. But Nas just spoke direct, and it was always so awesome, you know, to kind of hear him perform. And all of his records were just incredible. I bought everything after that. I dug deeper. I went to find tapes that he might have like rapped on whenever you'd go to like jams or parties or whatever. I try to find every single thing that was related to Nas, and I would pay top dollar.
Really strong influence. Yeah.
Yeah. So
it's interesting. It reminds me of, I remember one of my writing teachers telling me once that if you have someone that you're inspired by, it's okay to try and copy their style. And you can copy it, because then your natural talent or your style will come through that.
That's so true.
So it's okay to have that kind of role model and copy their style.
So it's almost like you'll find yourself naturally through that,
their
right?
style. Yeah.
Yeah.
So you're not just imitating it, but like that's the ideal goal, of course. You use their style as a role model, if you like, or their technique or their way of singing or directing.
Mm.
And we had students like this, I remember, in my class who had really, really good work, like fantastic work. And you could see that their style of directing was very similar to, let's say, well-known filmmakers.
Mm-hmm.
And then some of the other students would be like, well, he's just copying this other person. the teacher would be like, no, that's fine, because you can start with that and that's okay, but then through that you'll find your own style.
Yeah.
Like, oh, that's interesting. I never really looked at it like that.
Wow, that's like there's something someone told me once. It's called sitting on the shoulders of giants.
Of giants, yeah.
And that's pretty cool. Because you got to mimic it to be able to see what they were seeing and then take it further. Because no idea is original. There's nothing new under the sun. It's never what you do, but how it's done.
Yeah.
That's also from Nas as well. He has a song.
That's right. Okay, I've heard this.
You know what I mean? You've heard it too, yeah.
Yeah, I didn't know it was from him.
Yeah, it's crazy. This is what I'm saying. It all connects somehow. But it was really, really great to kind of fall in love with that aspect of it and then find somebody who was that epic at it, you know? With filmmaking, I kind of started going backwards. You know, I'd look at all the great filmmakers, and then I started looking at the great directors and cinematographers. I really love Roger Deakins, and he's probably my favorite cinematographer. So it's just that. But also, I got to this point where I stopped getting influenced because I decided to kind of to be experimental. You have to find something new and a new sound, right? Because with hip hop, it's not that difficult to sound like other people, especially with flows. You know, a lot of the time you put on the radio right now, and if it's something from Atlanta, you don't know who it is. You know, who is that? Who is that? Because a lot of the time people sound the same. And
yeah,
to distinguish yourself and be different, you know, and I'm not talking about cadence like your voice or something like that. I just mean just to actually have a different sound, something interesting about you. And I know we both watched the Bohemian Rhapsody movie, right?
With
Mercury. And you can see that Queen just did not sound like anybody else at the time. And this is the thing. And they would push the benchmark and try to be really different. And that's aspect of it. And it's not even try to be different. You are different, but you're experimenting and not following the mold, right?
Yeah.
And so that's it. I got to that point now where I just don't get that inspired by other people. I'm trying to find inspiration in other things and bringing it into my practice. So it's just something simple, like rather than me listening to a song and saying that song really inspired me, I could take a walk and maybe look at some art, and maybe if the art inspires the words as opposed to other people's music inspiring my words. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because artistically, it's still an artistic, like art, whether it's on a painting, can still inspire you the same way a song can. So if I draw my inspiration from, say, I don't know, Picasso, this, that, or whatever, then the inspiration will still be valid, but more original, because not everyone is drawing inspiration from the same thing.
Because it's from a different source.
Exactly.
Absolutely, yeah. I agree with that. I think you find the inspiration from things which have nothing to do with your field. Whether if I'm into, let's say we're doing the podcast or we're writing something, but then some of my inspiration may be from other sport or a movie that's got nothing to do with what I'm doing. But then I think it's about the energy and the attitude that they bring. Exactly. And then that's what inspires you.
Exactly. Yeah, that's pretty much it.
On top of all the things that you do, how do you relax? How do you wind down? What kind of keeps you grounded?
I guess it's funny because if you talk to other musicians, right, and you find out the same thing from them, right? I'm a normal guy. I like watching movies. I like playing video games. I like, you know, playing basketball or going to the gym or doing this to kind of unwind. But that's more, I find like that's more to distract my mind as opposed to relax my mind, because I'm always more at peace when I'm doing what I love. It's such a weird thing. Like, if I'm at home and I have nothing to do and I'm really stressed out and I need something to do, I'll just make a song. And if that's my job, and the weird part of it is that's also what relaxes me the most, because after I complete this song and I'm listening back to it, I can then play this song like 40 million times, and it just makes me feel great every time I hear it because I've completed something, right? And so for me, that's what my true relaxation is. I only procrastinate while I create. It's always my case. Like, if I'm sitting down, I have to watch something that's going to aid my filmmaking or going to aid my music creation. Yeah. I have to sit down. So I'm so consumed by these things. Like, I care so much about music and so much about film. It's crazy. I think that's for me to relax. How do I unwind? I make music. That's the reality of it.
That's the ultimate, really, isn't it? They say find a job or a career that you love, that you don't feel like you need to take a holiday. So you're relaxing is literally your job. So you don't need to worry about where the next holiday is or anything else, because you're doing what you love. That's very admirable. And I think that's what everyone strives to do ultimately. And it's very hard to actually do. So I think you found some special, what's the word? Like the golden key or whatever it is of life. I think you've actually discovered it.
Found Willy Wonka's golden ticket, have I?
The golden ticket, yeah, that's it. And you're actually living it, which is really admirable and very inspiring to hear as well. So one of the questions I ask everyone is, if you could go back in time to your younger self when you're a teenager, maybe 15, 18, maybe even 20, what would you say to yourself? What advice would you give to yourself to do things differently from what you've learned so far?
That's a really good question. I think for me, the most important thing that I find lacking now, that I'm still working on. If I had worked on before, I'd definitely be a lot further at this point. I think you have to find discipline. Discipline not in the sense that, you know, believe in something and go for it and that's it. No, I mean it in the simplest form. I mean it in structure and of your time. Because we do have time in abundance. I know life isn't actually that long, you know, considering, you know, you'll live to 110, maybe 120, some even, you know, way prematurely than that. But I think the importance of it is structure, because you want to do so much in this lifetime, right? And we all will at one point. You know, you want to go see the Maldives. Some people's aspirations might be as simple as that. You want to go on vacation somewhere. You want to see the world somewhere. Some people want to, you know, make it as an artist, or you want to make it as a filmmaker, or I don't know, you're a graphic designer, whatever. But I find that you have to still have enough time, of course, to have fun and not be like a... When we're on the film set, we always call them a time Nazi, and that's basically someone who's like keeping track of, oh, okay, it's time to reshoot now, you know, okay, we have 20 minutes to go, you know, like all of that is important. And of course, you'll always run over. You will never be too time, but you need some kind of structure to be able to manage everything you're trying to do. And I've been lucky enough that my partner, Chamonix, right now, you know, we're about to have a baby, which is really exciting. But the one...
Oh, yeah, congratulations. I really
appreciate it, man. Thank you. But I think that the most exciting part about my partner and how we work together is, you know, I'm always in the clouds. I'm in here. I let things run. I always wait too late. I always take too long. And I'm always looking at the future and I'm always doing this. But the important thing, she really keeps me grounded, because she's really introducing the most important thing, and that's structure. I find, like, by creating structure, I am now more focused. You know, it's like sharpening that sword. I'm so much more focused now that I can see I have this amount of time in my day to do this, this, and this, and this. I also now look at the future and also say, in the future, I need to do that, that, and that, and that. And I'm shaping actively what I have. You know, if imagination was a cloud, you know, and it's just always changing form. Sometimes it's going to be a dark cloud and rain. Sometimes it's going to be a light cloud. And sometimes it might be non-existent, like an invisible, you know, like just a blue sky. If that's what imagination is, and you have so much of it, and you want to do so much with your time, you really have to just be able to maintain a consistent cloud, as opposed to having one that changes shape every day. Because either way, it's still a cloud. It's still beautiful to look at, and it's still great. But if you give it structure, then your sky will always be however you want it to be. If you want it to be dark, it'll always be dark. If you want it to be a clear one, it'll always be a clear one. But that only comes with structure. So to the young Imar, that's what I tell. I tell that guy, I say, hey, stop fucking around, get some structure. And that's it.
Interesting. Yeah, discipline comes from structure. I think we think of discipline as this... Certainly for me, I think I used to hate the word discipline when I was younger. It sounded like a very rigid, cold, serious word for grown-ups. And I think just over time it evolved for me. And there was a post that was going around last year. I don't know if you remember, there was the Will Smith post where he talked about self-discipline is self-love. If you love yourself, you'll become disciplined, because you won't want to eat that extra donut, or maybe you won't want to go out because you need to study for a test. And I like the idea of that. Like I stopped seeing self-discipline as this rigid thing. It's more like, wait a minute, I care about myself, so I want the best for myself. Mm. And so I started focusing on that. And but definitely I agree with you. I think discipline is whatever feeling you have towards it. That is what it comes back down to, because you have to have that structure. It's not about cold rigidness. Of course, you can, you know, enjoy yourself and have fun, but to get to the next level of anything, to do anything right, you've got to have that discipline, the regularity of something. It's like going to the gym. You're not getting fit by going once 10 hours in a day. You're being disciplined, going regularly, or whatever habit you want to learn, a new language or something else. It's all about the power of habit. And oh, and I've got to say again, congratulations to Shimoni, to the two of you. I've met you both many times, and Shimoni's very lovely.
It's due like April 25th, but you know, this little guy, if he's anything like me, he'll decide when he decides. So
that's
pretty much it.
And do things on his own terms. You know?
But it's cool because it feels like a new phase of my life, you know, and that is for me something else to write about. I'm just so excited for the new stories I'm going to tell, for the new music I'm going to make, for the new kind of films I'm going to make. Like, it's a new kind of inspiration that you can only, you know, some people are privy to have in this lifetime. And I've really accepted it as a new form, as a new gift. And that's pretty much it, man. I'm about to get a whole nother palette and a whole nother, like, kind of colors to paint with for the rest of my life. And that's kind of great.
Yeah, I love the way you described having the experience of having a child as not just having an addition to your family, but really how you're going to see that as an experience which will add to your color palette, I think the word you used, color palette as an artist and how you see the world. And I love the way that you embrace all the experiences and take that in and see yourself develop, not just as an artist, just as a person. And that's really evolution and life, really, isn't it? In a nutshell, I love that. So I suppose my final question is, any books you'd recommend for anyone, not just kids, but anyone of any age, any books that you read which really stood out for you?
For me, if you're after something that's hip-hop related, music related, I forgot the name of the author, but I know the title is quite a long title. It's Does Sampling Impede on Creativity? And that's the focus on that was wondering whether or not chopping old pieces of music, you know, you have the legalities of it, which is like kind of whether or not it's morally okay to cut an old artist song and make a new song out of it. And then, you know, so does sampling laws, so that's specifically like, do sampling laws impede on musical creativity? And I remember it's that aspect, that fight between old and new, that fight between, you know, inspiration and not inspiration. The same thing we spoke about earlier about no ideas original and making new ideas. So that for hip hop is called Does Law Impede on Musical Creativity? And do sampling laws impede on musical creativity? Like a long title. That's really cool. But for writing and still film related, also forgot. I never remember the writers' names. Like, they're never important to me. I think what the words are in the book are is such a weird thing. But it was the name of the book is The Hero's Journey. And I'm sure, like, if you're a screenwriter or anything, you have the story. Yes,
Joseph Campbell.
That's the one.
Yeah,
I can always count on Sledge for people's names.
So where can we see more of your work or follow your work?
You can always catch me as, cause I have a production company, and my production company is On League. That's ON-League.com. For my music, I just go by the name MR, and you can find that everywhere, Apple Music, Spotify, and most of those places. If you're looking for me on social media, I also go by the same things, MR Music for my music, and for my film, I go as On League as well. So ON-League.
Great stuff. We'll put the links at the bottom of the podcast. So thank you very much, Ima, for joining us for this podcast. I really appreciate your time today.
It was really good talking to you, man. It felt like it was weird, man. It felt like a nice, calm therapy session. I've never seen a shrink in my life, but but if this is what it's like, then, you know, it's not too bad. You need to keep going to see your shrink.
Well, anytime, we'll invite you back and then you can do another one. Anytime you need to talk and let stuff out, we'll just have a therapy session. Me and you, we're just people listening in. You know, they won't tell anyone.
No worries, man. I appreciate it.
No problem. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Sledge.